This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Number one, keep your stops short and few. Two, eat before you're hungry, drink before you're thirsty. Three, never get too tired to eat or sleep. Four, add a layer before you're cold, take one off before you're hot. Five, lay off wine, meat and tobacco while on bicycle tour. Ride within yourself, especially in the first hour. Number seven, and the most important one, never show off. That's from Paul Levere, otherwise known as Veloce.
Well, we know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been. And we know what we're knowing, but we can't say what we've seen. And we're not little children, and we know what we want.
Yeah, that's right. Give that a wind down. Let those pedals turn a little bit slower. Get the heart rate down again. Many thanks to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now!, a window into America's soul, as I always like to think about it. We've got a topical show coming up today. How far do we push the e-bike revolution? Who's in charge? What's going to happen next? A fascinating topic, actually. And Faith, good morning.
Good morning, Val.
And to join us in this puzzle, I've got to say, Elliot Fishman, Director of the Institute of Sensible Transport. I nearly gave you a ride back. I give you a promotion, yeah, Elliot. Yeah,
which got a new job.
Yeah. Which I think you're eminently qualified.
Thank you.
I must say. So, look, we're going to be tackling that whole e-scooter, e-bike conundrum here in Melbourne and everywhere in Australia, actually. Faith, want a bit of bike moment?
I think my bike moments lately have been non-specific, but that small, vague and general sense that spring is in the air. I've been, I think for the last week on rides where I thought, are we about to get swooped? Like, it's even on the days where the wind was bitterly cold from the south, there was still that feeling that things were changing. And if you did end up in a sun trap, the sun was quite warm.
Mm. Yeah. Elliot?
Yeah. I was I'm now like a soccer dad, I suppose, because both my girls play soccer, and it's really interesting going to the games on Sunday morning, and the further out you go, because the league, for some reason, it can extend as far as, like, I was on the edge of the M80 Ring Road yesterday in Glenroy, and the week before that, I was in Princess Park in Carlton, and just to notice the difference in the way people get to the ground based upon where the ground is, and so in Princess Park, it was just full of e-cargo bikes that were carrying two kids on the back, and everyone was really well kitted out, and it's something that you just wouldn't have seen 10 or 15 years ago, and it's that combination of the market responding with a bike that's suitable for carrying kids, but also, and this relates to the conversation that we've got today, is they're all electric assist bikes because carrying two kids on the back with all their school books and whatever up a hill, that's hard, and that's where it's much better to have those people on a electric assist bike than in a SUV.
And that, because my son played soccer years ago, and I remember the same when we went to Sumner Park in Brunswick. Most people had walked or ridden, and then they were non-electric buckfeet, the box bikes, but then when we had games at Darabin, even that, just that little bit further north, bigger distances, less hospitable roads, unless you could come along the creek. A lot more people arriving in cars, and yeah, really noticeable difference.
It changes, it changes, it changes. I'm a little bit like you. All of a sudden, the river's covered in wattle trees. It's the first week of August. I have to re-look up the day for wattle nuts. Not till the 1st of September, and we are a bit close. Look, by my bike moment is a little... you know, the last show we did a bit of a... Andrea came in, a bit of a memorial for John England, and I went up to his memorial service on the Monday, rode up the upfield bike path, of course, which John spent a lot of years making sure that ended up all right. And I'm going to say, Elliot, there was a large collection of older critical mass riders. It was really... an exceptional example of a collection of people who have committed to activism, to make trying to make their voice heard, still going strong. Like it was, they're really still going hard at it. It was really so enlivening, really put it around. You go, God, just, you know, people fight, you know, for everything. It was great.
And I think it really spoke to the way John brought those different people together.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes the people who knew him, particularly from Climate Action, Mary Beck, didn't know that he'd been going to critical mass for decades and that he had that community. And people who knew him from somewhere else didn't know that he was, you know, the bug people who he'd been a member of for years didn't know that he was part of another community. And that event really brought all those communities together.
Which... I ran into, I used to work in the construction industry for a while, obviously hurt myself as an old person, but was doing all my training and assessment courses and first aid and all those things with the CMFEU in those days. And one of my old teachers from those days was at John's funeral.
Yeah.
The connections between was just most
the
unlikely.
Anarchists,
a good collection of 3CR people are there, of course, as well. It was really really well attended, but it was fascinating to see that that fire hasn't died out at all. You know, really heartening it was. And on with that, we've got a little bit of news. France at last. great win. To win a mountain bike gold medal and then go on to win the Tour de Femmes. So pretty, shows a pretty lovely cross section of skills. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bit like Marianne Vos.
Exactly. You're stealing the words right out of my mouth. Hey, listen, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back talking about electricity.
Yarrabug would like to thank Bicycle Network for their financial support. Bicycle Network, a not-for-profit with 45,000 members, working to get more people riding for their health and well-being. Bicycle Network is proud to sponsor the Yarrabug program and support its important advocacy for safer and more accessible riding. By becoming a Bicycle Network member and or participating in one of their iconic riding events, you're supporting Bicycle Network's Ride to School programs and advocacy campaigns to make it easier for everyone to ride a bike every day. Visit bicyclenetwork.com.au for more information.
And you're back listening to the Yarrabug Radio Show. And just want to thank Bicycle Network for their sponsorship of the show. I think this is the very first time Bicycle Network have sponsored Yarrabug Radio Show. And really good to see that sort of relationship between Bicycle Network and bicycle user groups.
Yes, and good.
Yep.
Yep.
And today we've got Elliot Fishman from the Institute for Sensible Transport in the studio to talk about some proposed changes that were sort of sprung quietly. There's a consultation from the Department of Transport at the moment on conduct on public transport regulations, and it includes some small changes to the regulations like not just not being able to put your feet on the seat, but not being soiling seats. And snuck in there is a total ban on people travelling on trains with their electric bikes, all sorts of electric bikes. So we thought that's a point that's, I think, ripe for some discussion. Elliot, what are your first thoughts on that sort of proposal?
It sounded a little bit extreme to me, given that it's a very common practice for people to bring an electric assist bike onto a train, yet there's only been, to my knowledge, one incident of fire with somebody who's carrying a e-bike with a lithium battery. So to my mind, the issue here is to be able to weigh up the likelihood of something happening and the consequences of something happening, and that will inform how much risk there is, because there are some things that are highly consequential but very low risk, is a very low likelihood, which means that the risk is moderate, whereas there are other things that are both highly likely and the consequences are very high, and they're the things that you definitely want to ban, whether it's, you know, on all sorts of things, you can use that framework. That's just a basic risk management framework. So it doesn't seem clear to me that they've weighed up both all the potential negative consequences and the positive things that happen when you allow people to be able to travel with a diversity of different bikes to get to a train station. And I think it's very clear, at least from my experience, is that there are lots of people that are replacing a car trip, that are doing things that are beyond what they would feel comfortable doing on a regular 100% pedal-powered bike. And it means that they don't need to rely as much on motor vehicles, whether it be parking at a train station or making the entire trip with a car. So it's got some obvious benefits. And it's not clear to me that they've used a careful assessment of both the benefits and the negatives of bringing e-bikes onto trains. And perhaps if they did that, and they can only really do that by having proper community engagement to find out from all the different stakeholders that are affected what impact that would have on their lives and their travel behaviour. And so until they've done that, they can't really make an informed decision.
Yeah. And it does seem, the documents from the DTP supporting the consultation do mention that the batteries they're concerned about are the ones used often in home conversions, so quite possibly cheaper batteries bought from less reliable sources, and the cheaper e-bikes that don't meet the, for example, the European standards that used to be used in Australia. So banning every e-bike, are there concerns about the batteries used on the bikes sold through reputable bike stores?
To my knowledge, the reputable brands haven't had any instance of fire, whether it be while charging or not charging. So, Shimano or Bosch motors and batteries haven't had any instances of fire. So it seems like perhaps what should be happening is that regulation upstream when the devices are coming into Australia is what needs to happen, because at the moment it's a little bit like the Wild West. I mean, you can go into a bike shop at the moment or an e-scooter shop and get a scooter that they quite openly market as being a device that can travel 90 kilometres an hour. Now, there's just no way that a vehicle with very small wheels like that can travel safely at 90 kilometres an hour, but that's... And the way that the bike shops get around it is by saying, oh, well, you can't use it on a public road, but you can use it on your country estate. And I don't know how many of these e-scooters are being used on people's country estate.
Well, and a lot of them aren't even bike shops. I know a favourite snowboard shop in summer sells e-bikes and e-scooters, but they're not the sorts that, they're being sold in the way that you're describing. So they're not even necessarily being sold by specialised bike shops.
So in a sense, I think what we're doing is blaming the victim, the victim for people that need mobility, whether it's because they participate in the food delivery gig economy business or for another reason, they're picking a bike that they're able to procure, sometimes off the internet, And there are no checks and balances in terms of importing, and there's also no checks and balances in terms of enforcement. So if you ask the police, they will tell you that they don't have the ability to be able to check a device to see whether it's got a power output that is higher than the standard, and that they are also very reluctant to look at speed as well. So there are lots of e-bikes that are going around that are travelling 45, 50 kilometres an hour, and they're probably also the ones that have batteries and chargers that are incompatible with each other, which is also where you get a lot of the battery fires, where you've got a charger that's giving an amount of electricity to the battery that is not what the battery is designed to take.
Uh-huh. And that's something a coroner in Melbourne, it was Coroner Audrey Jamieson, first recommended in 2018, not only that the Victorian government should better regulate e-bikes, but the Victoria Police should be given, I've forgotten the name of the tool you used, but they don't actually have the tool you need to measure whether or not that bike is compliant. So
That's right. And there are other countries that do that. So, for example, in the Netherlands, they've got a mobile unit that could be put out on the street, and so there can be random checks sometimes not random checks, where they've clearly seen that a bike is going well above the limit. They can haul it over and do a check on the spot, and then make a decision about whether it's above or within the limit.
And in the Netherlands, they impound 10,000 non-compliant e-bikes a year.
Right.
So it can be done.
Yeah.
The Netherlands is not necessarily much bigger than Victoria. So, there's probably concentrations of these bikes. We know everyone sees them, so it can be done. So the coroner asked the Victorian government to start better regulating the e-bikes people were using 7 years ago, and then you mentioned the change in 2021 the Morrison government made so that it was even easier to bring more bikes in. So this is a situation that's been around for 7 years in which something could have been done. If this ban goes ahead, what are the chances do you think that the government will feel any urgency in fixing it and rescinding it?
I think the urgency will be really depleted. There won't be much urgency to amend it in a sustainable way. Once they've instituted the ban, I think it will just be the ban. And the problem will be that whoever the next minister is in 4 years' time, when they potentially reconsider it, will be thinking, what about if I change the regulation, and then six months later, there's a fire. It will look like I did a bad job, and so the history of transport safety is that ministers are very reluctant to change it in a way that it could be construed later on that it was their change that caused a death, caused a fire, caused some sort of incident. So, I think if we institute the ban, it will be with us for a very long time.
I can see this as falling between a federal regulation and state enforcement in a lot of ways. Do we have product safety regulations that stop those batteries coming in, or we don't?
No. Well, the Morrison government, with the they amended the Motor Vehicle Standards Act to remove e-bikes as a class of road vehicles. So it's made it much easier. In practical sense, what it's done is made it much easier to be able to import a e-bike that doesn't comply with the standards, almost with impunity. So that's a real problem.
And they're safety standards. They're not, they're about actually consumer safety.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess there's multiple different angles here. One is the electrical wiring and compliance and making sure that the charger and the battery are compatible with one another to stop battery fires, which is a legitimate problem and it's caused fires to buildings. And then another one is the operation of the vehicle itself when it's on the road, because at the moment the rule is that you need to be pedalling in order for the motor to engage. I'm not necessarily too fussed about that. I think that's almost more of a you're not a real bike because you're not working hard, you're not moving the pedals. Yeah, well, you know, okay, fine. But that's not really about road safety. I think what is important is that there's a cut-off speed limit and, just as importantly, that these bikes aren't ridden on footpaths. And a lot of the time they are being ridden on footpaths. So one of my colleagues who lives in Carlton, and he sees it all the time, of bikes going, you know, 25, 30 kilometres an hour on the footpath. Mm. And that presents a risk to all pedestrians, but especially those that have vulnerabilities that mean that they can't see that person riding on a bike really fast on the footpath. And that is something that I would like to see. I'd be quite happy for the police if Victorian government want to really enforce improved safety on in our transport system, making sure that there's safe places for people to ride and there are penalties in place and there's enforcement to stop cyclists on e-powered bikes going fast on the footpath, because that is an unacceptable level of risk to pedestrians.
Mm. And shared paths. And I think because sometimes some of the, often they're called electric, unregisterable electric motorbikes. Mm. You often see people who do wear a full motorcycle helmet and some people are like, oh, well, at least they're doing the right thing. But it makes them far more dangerous to the pedestrians and other riders on that shared path if they do crash into them. And they're not only on a heavy, fast bike, but they're armoured up.
Like, their own personal safety, but it's not doing anything to help the safety.
It's like, you know, you put the bull bar on the big SUV and it makes it far more dangerous to everyone outside the SUV. Mm-hmm. So it extends, besides the issue with the trains, there's a lot of, obviously, road safety issues with these unregulated bikes.
Yeah, I've been seeing more of those full-face motorcycle helmets, and it does concern me because it says something about the capabilities of that bike that they're on, or e-scooter, and it says something about the way that they want to ride it that would be to the detriment of all the other road users around them.
I've been buzzed a few times by the speed differential is the thing that... look, just a couple of things. On the thing on the trains, if I'm in a mobility scooter and a battery, are they going to stop me getting on the train?
No. And I think the thing is the marketplace has not seen a huge benefit in bringing in masses of mobility scooters with cheap, crappy batteries. That's the difference. And maybe, I don't know if you're buying them through the NDS, I don't know if that's regulated, where you can buy it from.
Yeah.
But that's the issue. I was also talking to someone whose son is an electrician, and a lot of tradies, you know, we know the Southern Cross in the station in the morning, there's a lot of people getting off and going to work at 7 a.m. with their e-bikes. Mm-hmm. But even those without e-bikes in their bags will often have three batteries for their tools. But he was saying they often are buying decent quality ones because they want them to last. Yeah. So there's sort of informal reasons why you're less likely to get those batteries that are about to burst into flames.
Right. Yeah, it's not as though there's something inherent, fundamental to lithium batteries that means that they are going to explode. It's where you get that combination of really poor quality and an incompatible charger with a battery as well. But we know how to do good quality batteries that don't spontaneously combust, and we need to make sure that they're the only ones that are coming into the country.
Yeah. And for delivery riders, I mean, these are people who are earning very little in poor conditions and they're usually renting their bikes. Again, we've known they are renting bikes that are suboptimal and don't comply for 10 years, and yet has anyone done anything to try and change that and give them access to make sure they have to have access to decent bikes?
Yeah, there hasn't been any concerted effort that's visible to achieve that. But you can still, even today, you can go down, you know, even 800 metres from where we are right now, you can go down to one of these shops that specialise in the provision of food delivery bikes, and they've got a whole stack of pre-printed forms, waivers that you can sign if you want to go in there and say, can you change it so that instead of cutting out at 25 kilometres, the motor cuts out at 35 kilometres, and so they're all ready to go. You just sign it to say that you understand that that's not legally able to be used on our roads, and then the bike shop thinks that they've done their job, and it's now the fault of the person,
consumer,
who's buying these bikes to do food delivery, where the apps require you to make deliveries within a certain period of time.
Yeah.
So it's got something to do with that as well. We've got this time pressure, whether it be for food delivery apps or even shared e-scooters where they charge by the minute. And so people who are time or financially pressured at looking to make that trip as quickly as possible, which encourages them to do things they might not have done otherwise.
Yeah. So if we ban delivery riders and, for example, maybe apprentices who need to get to Campbellfield by 7 a.m. From taking their current electric bike on the train, because the delivery riders are generally not living in the area where they're doing all the work, are we going to find they have an even greater incentive to buy a more powerful non-compliant bike to cover that train trip?
Yeah, look, I think there's a number of different avenues that people could take if they were faced with the ban that's been proposed. And one of them is what you've just said, which is, well, okay, I'll buy a bike that can go 45 kilometres an hour. I'll make the whole trip. I wonder how many people are going to face the consequences of serious injury or possibly even death by doing that instead of being able to take a more mildly powered e-bike on a train. So, and that's the importance of doing a very careful cost and benefit analysis, a pros and cons list of what happens if you were to institute a ban, because unless you've done that, you don't really know what the unintended consequences like the one that you've just identified might be, and you can't really make public policy just on the fly like that, which is what they appear to be doing.
And does the state government know how many e-bikes travel on trains every day and where they're going?
No, they've got no insight on that at all.
No. So we're making this really significant policy change that will have a huge impact personally in people's lives, diminish their access to certain work, impact recreational access, be terrible for people with disabilities or medical conditions that mean they can't drive, for example. And there's this complete vacuum of information about what we're doing and what the impact will be.
Yeah, I mean, it's not all that different to, and we'll talk about this before the show, in 2008 when the Minister for Public Transport at the time decided to just ban bikes on trains, and then people that rely on carrying their bikes on trains got in touch and they had a round table and they decided, actually, that wasn't such a good idea. Let's forget we ever mentioned that. And it might, hopefully, the same sort of thing will happen this time around.
Because the bike-train combination, that is a part of the public transport system that the state government manages. So it's...
Mm. I find this fascinating. Can I give you another example? I mean, the federal government has the regulations, but then they rely on the Victorian police or the state government to actually enforce it. Mm. So if you take the illegal tobacco market, which customs, which are called Border Force now, and the taxation department are in charge of tobacco imports in Australia, they're obviously doing nothing at all, but now the Victorian government really can't do anything about all those shops, and we all can see how quickly that's changed. The only thing I've found different in this is South Australia, they've set up a squad in South Australia, a separate squad, to target illegal vaping and tobacco shops, and they're cracking down on them. Nothing you'll see here. We're stuck between a federal regulation and then a state trying to enforce those regulations. Mm. And it looks like everything just falls through the middle.
Mm. I mean, and where these two topics collide is with the fire that happened at Cargo Cycles in Brunswick, where I think the perpetrators of the fire were actually trying to firebomb another entity, and they ended up getting the bike shop... caught on fire, and they have to close down for a bit to repair. So those two things aren't that far off.
Or even...
Well, I suppose, anyway, we got to look at the money behind it sometimes, but illegal tobacco is coming from gangsters. Yeah, so, but anyway,
that's right.
So as we mentioned, there is currently a survey you can take part in, or you can upload a submission. It's at engage.vic.gov.au, and it is called Conduct on Public Transport Regulations. We'll put a link to it in the podcast, but otherwise you can Google it in the meantime. I would suggest it's not enough just to take part in that consultation. I think you should also be contacting your local MP and the Minister for Transport, because I find it astonishing that a whole number of people are about to be disenfranchised from public transport, and no one knows how many, for how long.
Or why.
Like, there's no end date to this proposed ban. There's on the website. There's nothing. So best to make a submission. You might not use an e-bike now, but you might one day want to or need to.
Yes. And I think that's about all we've got time for.
That's all we have time for today.
Thank you, Elliot.
Thanks for having me.
And next up is?
Shebop.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.